Eivos is not human. His development is, admittedly, proceeding at a far faster rate than even the most gifted child, but his brain is still at the most plastic, malleable stage.
I still don't see how our relationship is dangerous.
Well, Carstairs considered it so. You would have been left with no contact at all if it hadn't been for Eivos himself. He insisted on seeing you.
I blushed, betrayed by my body again.
Carstairs then imposed a new approach to his and our relationship with Eivos. Parent to child, authority figure to subordinate. He set us to work to help him achieve it.
Wait, why is it a good thing to have Eivos treating you, or Carstairs, as if you're his superior? It's not true.
Chris, it's not a case of superiority.
He looked at my face.
Well, for now perhaps it is, but it's temporary. During this foundational period, it's healthy for Eivos to look up to us, to have boundaries, to flourish within the same kind of parent-child model that has worked for humanity.
But he's not human.
Well, quite so. Would you want a toddler with superpowers deciding to go on the rampage? Or would you rather a well-behaved child who obeys his elders?
I glared at him. What gives you the right?
National security, the safety of the world, and the fact that we agreed to follow orders when we signed up to work for Station. Come on, Cress, it's for the best.
He was feeling a bit more secure. Perhaps he thought I was wavering. He even smiled tentatively. What precisely is in that powder you give him, Father? He stopped smiling. Father distanced himself from his behaviour by going into professional mode, knowing full well I wouldn't be able to follow everything. I stopped him and, despite his protestations, made notes.
The powder is a mixture. We had to experiment with quantities and dosage. Now there is some vitamin D in there. The label wasn't completely inaccurate. We've found chlorpromazine works to a certain extent if we were very careful with dosage. We considered an injection of sodium pyothentol might be more effective, but it induced an almost catatonic state, followed by an absolute refusal by the subject to allow future injections.
Boxing Day, I said, but Father was still talking.
In the end, it was an experimental American drug that proved to be the best fit. It's at its earliest developmental stage, but quetiapine proved very efficient for our purposes when mixed with chlorpromazine. We used some more common synaptic inhibitors, of course, considering our lack of a control group and the highly experimental nature of the treatment. We managed extraordinarily well, developing within a short period.
What does the drug do? He stopped in mid-flow, then thought for a moment, choosing his words carefully.
Chris, it doesn't hurt Eivos in any way. I want you to know that.
What does it do?
It slows him down, Cress. It makes him more reliant on us, more compliant. It makes him suggestible. The education program Carstairs started enables us to help Eivos become a patriotic defender of democracy, freedom, and the British way of life.
With an effort, I ungritted my teeth. You're brainwashing him.
Now, Cress, that's not true. We want Eivos to embrace the right values as he grows. We don't want a super-powered Nazi or communist flying around the place, do we?
You're brainwashing him, I repeated, all the pent-up anger draining out of me in a wave of tiredness. It was all I could do to hold my head up. How could you? You, a scientist, a father. How can you help Carstairs abuse Eivos?
Chris, don't be naive. There are some decisions that are too serious to be taken by individuals like us. Some threats to our country must be dealt with by institutions like Station.
Is that how you see him? My tone was flat. As a threat?
No, probably not, but that's my point. I am not qualified to make that kind of assessment. Neither are you. Particularly you, I'm afraid.
What do you mean by that?
Carstairs claims you're in love with Eivos. Now, I can't say I agree, but I have concerns about your relationship. I worry about it, as should you, Cress. He's not human.
My face flushed again, and I felt some energy finally return, along with my embarrassment and anger.
How dare you! How dare you!
It was good to raise my voice, to challenge Father, to force him to defend the indefensible.
If you continue blindly messing around with his brain chemistry, we may never discover who he is. You can't possibly know what kind of damage you may be doing to him. How could you?
There are risks, Cress, I don't deny it, but what choice do I have?
You have the choice to say no, to refuse to help, to rally support from your fellow scientists and make Carstairs see that this is wrong.
Father shook his head.
But I don't believe it is wrong, and if I were to walk away, they would appoint someone else. No one has quite the level of expertise and experience with the subject that I do. It would be irresponsible in the extreme. I can't do it.
I sat and looked at him, then stood up and left the room. An hour ago, Father knocked on my door. I didn't answer, but I listened.
I don't know what you're thinking of doing, Cress, but please remember how deeply involved I am at station. I could never walk away without endangering you. Their methods are brutal, morally indefensible perhaps, but effective. If you can't trust yourself not to interfere, you must ask for that transfer. An attempt to thwart Carstairs would be seen as treason. Treason, Cressida. They would lock you away for the rest of your life. We are trapped, both of us.
He's right, of course. Such a logical man. I want to hate him for what he's doing, but I can't. He's still my father. I can't go back to station. I'll ask for a transfer tomorrow. I feel like I've betrayed Abos, and my betrayal is the worst of all.
Chapter 27. I underestimated station. Hopkins and others like him are the kind of people who say the end justifies the means, as if it's true, as if repeating it with absolute belief somehow makes it acceptable, as if the end they are pursuing justifies any means that they choose. Betrayal, lies, manipulation, brainwashing, violence, torture, death. Beware those who are certain of their beliefs. If in doubt, good. I said sometimes you don't know when a chapter in your life is about to come to an end. The chapter that closed for me in that corridor with Tweedledum and Tweedledummer was followed by blank, empty, wasted pages. Hard to think about it, even now. I was a young man. Still a kid in many ways. At least, at the end of it all, there was still the best chapter of all. I met George, the single most important person in my life, even though our time together was short. I went to sleep one day at the age of 21. When George woke me up, I was 35. When I look back on those years, which is something I've avoided, it's easier to pretend I was unconscious the whole time. It means I can treat my memories as dreams or nightmares. The truth was, I was conscious for between 6 and 8 hours every day, according to George. During this period, I exercised, ate, and performed essential bodily functions. There were children's books to read, to keep my mind stimulated. Not too stimulated. Lots of Enid Blyton, but no Roald Dahl. My captors really were prize bastards. The children's books were necessary because of a side effect of the drugs. I could reason to a certain extent. I could make straightforward decisions. Should I eat the banana first or the sandwich? Will today's story be the faraway tree or Noddy? But anything more taxing brought on a headache. I didn't sleep as much. It was more of a daily medically induced coma. I always had a cannula on one end of my hands connecting to a drip on a wheeled stand. I would wake at some point every day. I'm only guessing it was every day. I have no way of knowing conclusively as my room had no windows, clocks or calendars. The first thing I would see would be a doctor or a nurse checking my chart. They would ask inane questions about how I was feeling, then put a fresh bag in my drip. Whatever they gave me kept me docile, obedient, and hardly present in any meaningful way. I would let myself be fed, then led to the toilet. In the toilet, I would sometimes remember to look at my body. There were often dressings on my chest or side. There was no shower or bath, just a small sink. I don't remember that I smelt bad, so they must have given me sponge baths in bed. There was a small gym next door. It had a treadmill and an exercise bike, plus resistance machines to maintain muscle tone. While I worked out, anodyne New Age music played, with a voiceover murmuring feel-good mantras. I can't remember a single one, but I enjoyed listening to them. Remembering that makes me angry. Even now, if I see a motivational poster, I want to puke. After exercise, there was more food. Sometimes a doctor would visit and ask questions. They would ask me to remove my cotton pajamas. They'd use a felt-tip pen to draw lines and arrows on my body before making notes. I was allowed to read afterwards. There was no television or radio. After what seemed like an hour, the lights would dim. My drip would be changed. Soon afterwards, I would feel tired, my eyelids would droop, and a nurse would help me to bed. I didn't sleep, I was unconscious. I had no dreams. That was the pattern of my life, without variation, for 14 years. The day everything changed started the same as any other. A nurse, a new drip, a slow float to the surface where a kind of half-consciousness awaited. Good morning, Daniel. This at least served the purpose of reminding me of my name. I'm not sure I would have known it otherwise. Daniel Harbin was in there somewhere, but deep down, inert, waiting. Food, toilet, gym. No doctor visited. I sat at the small desk and looked at the selection of books. Had I already read The Adventures of the Wishing Chair? The cover looked familiar, but I couldn't remember anything about it. I started reading. Within a page or two, I stopped. It seemed unsatisfying. I wasn't enjoying the story. I pushed it away and opened The Faraway Tree. After a paragraph, I dropped it in frustration and picked up Lookout, Secret 7. My head felt strange. Things were moving inside my skull, the tectonic plates of personality shifting. I felt adrift, confused. The door opened, and someone came in. It took me a while to respond. I read the same line a few times, then lifted my head. A visitor, not a doctor, or a nurse. This was new. I stared at her. She was in a wheelchair and was the first person I'd seen in more than a decade who wasn't wearing a medical uniform. She was about my age, mixed race, wiry black hair, pulled back with a red headband. She wore a shapeless brown and black dress that gave little indication as to the shape of her body. Her face was thin, her skin a little sallow. Her gold-flecked brown eyes regarded me with ferocious intelligence. My mouth went dry. A tremor had disturbed the surface of my drug-maintained calm. When she spoke, her voice was a surprise. It was rich, warm, cheerful. Even that first time stoned out of my mind, I know it did me good to hear it. "It's taken me a long, long time to find you, Daniel. You're the first of us, and you're the strongest. They've treated you badly, but it ends today. It ends now." I felt a strange stirring, a sensation I couldn't place. It was a feeling I hadn't experienced for 14 years, and my mind went through such a grating gear shift to allow it that I felt dizzy. I gripped the side of the desk for a moment, then recognized the odd sensation for what it was. Was curiosity. My brain was very slowly, very painfully waking up. I looked at the drip on its stands next to the desk. "Yesterday's dose was half strength," said my visitor. "The one hanging there now is a saline solution. I need you to to be you, Daniel. I'm a clever woman, and I have some tricks up my sleeve. But if we're going to break out of station, I'm going to need you to smash a few things. I blinked. Moment by moment, I felt myself returning. But it was a nightmarish sensation, bringing with it memories I didn't want to face, and a sickening suspicion about the length of my stay in that sterile, windowless room.
How long?
My voice sounded strange to my ears, weak, croaky, deeper in pitch than I remembered. I coughed.
How long have I been here?
She sighed. Her hands were together on her lap, but they were not resting there. Her right hand held the wrist of her left tightly. When she let go, her left hand twitched and spasmed. With an effort, she placed her right hand on mine. Her skin was dry and warm, the pressure on my hand firm. She waited until I looked at her. Her voice was full of sympathy, but I saw strength and determination in her eyes.
14 years.
She waited. I was far from alert, and I couldn't comprehend what she had told me. I must have looked as blank and as numb as I felt because she squeezed my hand, and I gave a small smile.
We'll talk about it later, Daniel.
For now, I've bought us a few hours so you can get your strength up. I stared back at her. My hand went up to my upper arm, feeling the place where the power button used to be. There was no scar there, but I still felt a lump under the skin. The door opened, and a nurse pushed a covered trolley into the room. He was unfazed by the woman in the wheelchair. He nodded at us, left the trolley, and went out the way he had come in. My visitor took her hand from mine and tugged at the corner of the cloth covering the trolley. It fell away, revealing 2 whole cooked chickens and a bowl full of baked potatoes, spinach, peas, carrots, and cauliflower. There was a bunch of bananas and a full fruit bowl with apples, pears, and grapes. There was a jug full of milk and 2 glasses. She leaned across and set the 2 glasses on the desk.
Would you mind?
She said. I reached over and poured 2 glasses of milk, my hand shaking a little.
Thank you.
She took 3 bananas and put them in her lap.
The rest is for you.
You will need your strength, Daniel. She lifted her glass.
Cheers.
In a daze, I clinked my glass against hers, and we drank cold milk together, in a secret government facility buried in the heart of London. A woman in a wheelchair, and a man who had been drugged and kept asleep for 14 years. I felt that strange but increasingly welcome sensation again.
Who are you?
She smiled, then, the milk mustache giving her features an impish quality. Georgina Cuckoo, she said. Call me George. I'm your sister.
Chapter 28. George kept looking at her watch. I leaned over.
What time is it?
5:45. I frowned.
Morning or evening?
Evening. I pictured myself on a summer evening, walking along a street. It was a dreamlike image, insubstantial. I turned to George.
14 years.
2015. She nodded and handed me the last banana. The entire trolley's contents had been consumed, and George had done her fair share of the consuming. Considering she looked painfully thin, she could pack away her food. I wouldn't have wanted to challenge her to a pie-eating competition.
Maybe she really was my sister.
Half-sister. If we shared the same father, had she inherited some sort of power from him too? I looked at her again. A gust of wind could knock her over, never mind a bullet.
What month?
December. Christmas soon. I altered the mental picture, making it evening. Wintry, woolly hat weather, with coats buttoned up and scarves wrapped round faces. I made the street lamp-lit and added flakes of snow. Then I looked at the white walls, the drip, the monitor, the hospital bed. I couldn't believe my mental picture had any connection with reality. It felt less substantial than Enid Blyton's magical wishing chair, which could take you to far-off fantastical lands. I started to pull the needle out of the cannula. If we didn't go now, I was sure my mental image would turn out to be a fantasy, and I would never see the sun again. Let's go. George put a hand over mine and stopped me. If that needle leaves your vein for more than 5 seconds, you'll trigger an alarm. Wait. She looked at her watch again. 10 more minutes. You have to wait until after 6. Why? What happens then? Change of shift. She pointed at the banana I was holding. Eat up. At 6:05, there was a knock at the door. I stood up, fists clenching. Don't worry, said George, smiling. He's part of the plan. The door opened and a guard walked in. He was a big, burly man in his 30s. He unclipped his handgun and put it on the table before undressing. Folded his clothes at the end of the bed. I looked at George quizzically. Oh, he doesn't know we're here. The guard didn't turn at the sound of her voice, just unlaced and pushed off his boots before removing his trousers. He then went to the small wardrobe, took out my spare pajamas, and put them on. I whispered, not wanting to break whatever spell he was under. How? How is that possible? I mess with people's minds, Daniel, in a nice way. Usually. George dug into her pocket and brought out a sealed packet. She handed it to the guard, who opened it and removed a needle and cannula. Without hesitation, he found the vein on the back of his hand and tried to push the needle in. It took him 3 attempts to find it, and by the time he did, blood was dripping from his hand. He seemed not to notice. Daniel, transfer the drip, please. Remember, once it's out, you have 5 seconds. Still only half convinced this was really happening, I did as she asked with a casual confidence I may not have displayed had I been thinking straight. An idea occurred to me as the guard padded away and got into my bed. Are you messing with my mind? George laughed with open pleasure. Of course. Daniel, you've been in a semi-catatonic state for 14 years. If I wasn't giving you a kick start, it would take weeks before you would be in any kind of state to escape. I examine my own mental processes, as far as that's possible. I can't, I mean, nothing feels weird, what are you doing exactly? George spun her wheelchair to face the door. No time now, she said. I'll explain at the hotel. She gestured with her thumb at the pile of clothes. Get dressed and let's get moving. I promise I won't peek. The corridor outside was empty, just as George had promised. I insisted on opening the door, then running through, ready to confront any guards. She followed, chuckling at my frown. The guard on duty is now asleep in your bed. We won't meet anyone else on this level until we get to the stairs. Do you mind pushing? I took the handles of the wheelchair and walked along the corridor. After a few steps, I realized I was walking strangely. This was the first time I had gone any further than the distance from the bed to the bathroom, and my slight limp was now noticeable. The injury had long since scarred over, but even my enhanced healing ability couldn't grow back my toes. I looked at the walls. They looked different. They were light gray rather than olive, and there was no colored lines indicating routes to different divisions. Had they changed the paint scheme? Or was I on another level? As if she had been reading my mind, which she was, George spoke. You're 2 levels beneath the one you used to live in. This area is used for medical facilities. There are operating theatres and traditional hospital wards where injuries can be treated in-house. Mental health care too. Post-traumatic stress counselling. Cognitive behaviour therapy. Hypnotherapy. One of station's specialities, as you know. Physical therapy, too. I had a week session here for months. We still haven't seen a soul. If this level's layout was roughly the same as the one I knew, we should be a minute's walk from the stairwell. You've been here months? Yes. Nearly 8 months.
How did Station catch you?
She chuckled again. It wasn't dismissive. George was amused. She gave off the air of someone who was having a fabulous time. Oh, they didn't. I handed myself in.
You... Hold on, what? Why?
She looked over her shoulder as I pushed her around the last corner. At the far end, I saw the security door leading to the stairs. I needed something from Station, and I wanted to find out what they knew about us.
Us?
Half-heroes. There are more of us. Others survived.
Of course.
What did you need from Station? We had reached the door. I came to a halt. The thumbprint and code security protocols were still in operation. I hoped she had a plan. I needed help to find our dad. As I gawped at her, I heard footsteps. I put my hand on the butt of the guard's gun.
Relax,
said George. Dr. Copson just needs to check his code. He keeps fretting about forgetting it. A worried-looking man in his 60s hurried up to the door. He smiled at George. It was as if I wasn't even there.
Hello, George. How are you this evening?
Very well, thank you, Doctor. And you?
He stared at the keypad and rubbed the bridge of his nose. Yes, yes, I'm fit and healthy, thank you.
George smiled at him. 47786, isn't it? Dr. Copson smiled and punched in the numbers. He put his thumb in place. There was a click, and the heavy door swung open. He took a pace back, and I pushed George through, and the door started to close again. I heard him muttering, 47786, 47786. The door shut behind us with a metallic clunk, and I looked at the concrete stairs, then at George in her wheelchair, then back to the stairs again. She stuck her tongue out at me. And here's me thinking you're supposed to be strong. I lifted the chair onto one shoulder and took the stairs two at a time. George whooped with delight.
Show off, she said.
I paused at the next level. She shook her head. R&D, which, for 16 or 17 years, has meant hybrids. This whole level is where they are kept and trained. I stayed away because my abilities can't touch them. Once, just once, I got close enough to become aware of a hybrid. She shook her head. I can't reach their minds at all. They are so damaged, incomplete, full of confusion, pain, and rage. Poor things. I remembered the sound I'd heard when the hybrid had bitten through my foot. I felt rather less sympathy for them than George did. I carried her up to the next level and set her down by the door. Another thumbprint scanner. Another keypad for a code, but no sign of any help. George looked at her watch again. We're nearly a minute early. You're making good time. The stairs didn't go any further up. This was Station's top level. The central lifts were the only way to the streets from here. There were emergency stairs, but they could only be accessed from the same lobby as the lifts. That central hub was bound to be busy. I guess that was when George expected me to punch a few people. If not there, at the security check on the ground level. You've got it, said George, smiling. Right on schedule, there was a click, and the door in front of us opened, revealing a woman I'd seen a few times before. Her name evaded me for a few seconds. Then I had it. Ward. I had never been told her first name. She was older, of course. Her hair grey and cut short, the skin around her eyes furrowed. I remembered sitting across from her in the lorry before running across a field towards a barn. Someone had been firing at us. It went hazy after that.
Good to see you again, sir.
She saluted me. This way, please.
George raised an eyebrow at my expression. Ward turned on her heel and led us towards the lift. It was a 2-minute walk, during which our chaperone was saluted by half a dozen passing soldiers. She had obviously been promoted while I'd been dozing my life away. I wondered if Hopkins had moved on. Surely he'd passed the retirement age by now.
Still very much in control, I'm afraid, said George quietly. Her ability would take some getting used to. Hopkins has built himself a little empire down here, and since the hybrids have proved their worth in certain deniable military operations, the government won't rock the boat. We reached the lobby where Ward led us straight to a lift, the doors closing. Catching sight of her, one of two men inside held the door. The men exchanged nods with Ward as I pushed George into the lift. Not subordinates, then. Not in uniform, either. Specialists of some sort. This is where I leave you, said Ward, and saluted me again as the lift doors closed. I had no idea what George had been doing to her, but Ward had obviously not seen me as me. I wondered who she thought I was. I glanced at our two companions. If they were specialists, I doubted it was medicine or psych. They were both powerfully built and stood with a kind of relaxed readiness that made me nervous. Trained, dangerous. Something about them reminded me of my handlers. I wondered if that's what they were, but for the hybrids. It would take a certain ruthless, cold efficiency to do that job. They looked just the types. One of the men was looking at me. He had quite a full beard, despite the fact that he was in his mid-30s. He was either some kind of eccentric, or fashions had changed since I'd been locked away. I didn't like his expression. It was as if he thought he knew me, but didn't quite believe it. I nudged George. Beard spoke. Why would Lieutenant Colonel Ward salute a sergeant? Sergeant. I nudged George harder. She made an odd sound. He asked you a question. The second man was taking an interest now. He was clean-shaven and had a conspicuous neck tattoo. Maybe that was a fashion thing, too. I calculated we had about 30 seconds until the lift reached the ground floor. Neck tattoo was closest to the control panel and the alarm button. Beard was still looking, and I still didn't care for his expression. I said, stalling for time and giving George a little shake. I glanced down. She was snoring. Looked like I was on my own. Beard's gaze wandered from my neck down to my feet. The guard who'd taken my place had been a big bloke, no mistake. But no one got close to my measurements. The T-shirt under my jacket had ripped when I put it over my neck. The jacket itself was half opened, as I could wear it any other way. And, most telling of all, the trousers stopped 3 inches short of my boots, which were killing me. When his eyes flicked up to my face again, I saw the sudden recognition there. He reached for his handgun. It's... My elbow caught him in the stomach and knocked every last bit of breath out of him. He collapsed to the floor just in time for me to slap neck tattoo before he touched the alarm. He slammed into the side of the lift, then dropped. At that moment, there was a ting, and the doors slid open in front of station's security detail. Station was very, very determined never to allow any kind of security breach. So they had 3 layers of defense set up at street level. The first, a long desk behind which 2 retired station operatives boosted their pensions by dealing with members of the public who had wandered in by mistake, was purely cosmetic. There was a large metal turnstile that could only admit 1 at a time, and an internal wall that hid the rest of the lobby from view. Anyone who approached the desk was filmed, and the feed from the cameras monitored by operatives in a secure room downstairs. They were the second layer. If the operatives running the second layer thought there was a possible threat, they had 2 options, soft and hard. I had made a joke about that during my early days at station, but it earned me a withering stare from Hopkins. Not that I'd seen him come up with any other stare. As far as I knew, the withering stare was the only stare in his arsenal. Stick to what you're good at, I suppose. The soft option was 2 armed soldiers approaching the desk and suggesting the interlopers leave. Station had only used that option 2 times, and it had proved effective. Both occasions had been provoked by confused foreign tourists who didn't know they were being asked to leave. The international sign of having a loaded gun pointing at you had worked a treat. The hard option, as yet unused, brought down steel shutters at every door and window, locked down the lift and stairs, and brought 18 additional armed soldiers to deal with the problem. Should that be insufficient, gas was available. And, as Hopkins always made clear, should that final layer ever be breached, an alarm would go off in Whitehall. A phone call would be made, and station would be buried under 100,000 tons of rubble. There were some state secrets that were never intended to see the light of day. All in all, station's security arrangements were frighteningly thorough. There were two things in our favor. My power, and the fact that the entire security operation was designed to stop people getting in. No one had ever considered the possibility that someone hundreds of feet underground in the most secure facility ever built in the UK, surrounded by armed soldiers and hybrids, would ever consider, for a second, the possibility of trying to get out. They'd never make it more than a few feet. They hadn't counted on George. I knew I would have to make this quick. I'd only have a few seconds before the alarm was triggered. If the alarm was triggered. Perhaps there was another way. As the lift doors slid apart, I put the side of my foot against Beard. He was still gasping, and flipped him into the side of the lift, where he went quiet as hell on top of his colleague. I pressed the button to send it down again. I'd never been more grateful for my broad physique as I hunched over George's wheelchair and pushed her out, hiding the inside of the lift with my bulk while the doors slid shut behind me. There was one man waiting for the lift. He tried to go around me as I stepped out, but I grabbed his upper arm. "Are you a doctor?" I pointed at George. "She's had a seizure. I need help." Her snores undermined my case, but by then I could hear the sound of the lift starting its descent. "No," the man looked at my shoulder. "Sergeant, I am not a doctor. And, according to your uniform, you work for me. But I don't recognize you. What's your name?" He looked down at George doubtfully and stepped away, his hand moving closer to his gun. "I shaved, sir," I said, rubbing my chin. "I had a big old beard, bushy, great thing. That's probably why you..." He took half a step closer, squinting to read the name badge on my chest. I hit him, a very light uppercut, pulling my punch as much as I dared. Didn't want to kill him. His eyes rolled back. I caught him and lowered him to the floor. "Medic!" I called. Two armed soldiers ran in from the ready rooms concealed behind the internal wall. "What happened?" One of them knelt and took his pulse. "Some kind of fit, I think." He grabbed his head and fell over. The other guard talked him to his lapel, calling for medical assistance. I grabbed the front of my jacket and read the name badge upside down. I pushed George away. The first soldier called after me. "Sergeant, where do you think you're going?" I stopped and shot him a glare. "You seem to have this under control. Colonel Hopkins ordered me to get his goddaughter back to the hospital, and I have a taxi waiting. Would you like me to stay here with you instead? Perhaps you could help me explain to the Colonel how I let her miss her dialysis appointment." He hesitated. No one wanted to attract any kind of attention from Hopkins, ever. He thought for a second, then waved me away. I'd only taken three steps when he called me again. I turned, forcing an exasperated look onto my face. "What's your name, Sergeant?" "Marmagradable," I said. "Well, you tried reading something upside down under pressure." He stared at me. "It's spelt the way it sounds." I walked to the turnstile without looking back, holding up my security card as I got closer. "She's not well," I said. A security guard trotted over and opened a gate at the side so I could wheel her through. 10 seconds later, I was outside, hailing a taxi. George opened her eyes and I eased the chair into the cab. "What a lovely sleep. Did I miss anything?"
Chapter 29, October 5th, 1979.
It's been a while. I half thought I'd never write in this diary again. I was transferred to the Ministry of Agriculture 6 months ago. I collate data on fluctuations in land supply, and my boss makes recommendations to the minister. It's completely mindless work, but it requires concentration and an eye for detail. To my great surprise, I enjoy it. I come home pleasantly tired and never give a moment's thought to what passes across my desk once I leave the office. I sometimes consider the university education I passed up and wonder what might have been. I've never believed that life follows some sort of plan, that things happen for a reason. No. I was present at the scientific discovery of the century. Hence, I missed an education and a more stimulating career. I have regrets, but I can live with them. I have consciously avoided thinking about Abos, although my dreams refuse to play along with that decision. As for Father, our relationship has been dented somewhat, but blood is thicker than water. We find other things to talk about. Perhaps, eventually, we will be able to repair some of the damage. I'm only writing now because of what Father announced after dinner. My head is still reeling. I should have known that what he told me was inevitable at some point. Abos is about to go public. Tonight, a press release will land on the desk of every national newspaper, as well as every correspondent from around the world covering British news. Both the BBC and ITV are included. They will be given access so that they can broadcast the event live. Abos will be presented to a world that has no idea he exists. They are calling him Power Man. How utterly ridiculous. Father had the decency to look embarrassed when he told me. Father said I could go if I wanted to. The invited audience includes, as well as the press, ambassadors from the world's governments, representatives of our own government, most of whom were only told of Abos's existence today, and senior figures from the highest echelons of Britain's Army, Navy and Air Force. And me. Somewhere at the back, in a woolly hat, a thick scarf and a pair of sunglasses. If he happens to glance my way, he won't recognize me. Maybe he's forgotten me anyway. Tomorrow evening, broadcast live across the globe. Power Man. Good grief. Chapter 30. October 6th, 1979. The announcement was scheduled for 5 p.m, and all three British TV channels rearranged their schedules so that they could show it live. I travelled with Father in a station car. We didn't know where we were going until we got there. Although as we got closer, it became clear where Abos was making his debut. Wembley Stadium. Security was tight, and we passed through three checkpoints before being allowed to enter the stadium itself. A wooden stage had been erected on the pitch, and a public address system, the sort they use for rock bands, was stacked in two towers on either side. There was one microphone, but other than that, the stage was bare. The pitch was spotlit. We filed in and took our places, Father showing me to the back row in the stands before he headed towards a row nearer the front. I was seated with members of the foreign press, most of whom knew each other and were exchanging pleasantries. I saw a few shrugs in answer to the same question being asked over and over in multiple languages. Why are we here? There were almost 200 people present, according to my rough count. Ridiculous in a venue the size of Wembley. I craned my neck and looked at the backs of the heads nearer the front. I recognised Hopkins straight away. His seat was central, and as I looked away from him, I caught sight of Carstairs walking along the same road to join him. He looked up, and I shifted to one side, glad that the Irish journalist in front of me was wearing a large bobble hat. There were only two TV cameras there, one BBC, one ITV, which surprised me at first. Then I noticed that both cameramen were shadowed by a soldier, making sure they were filming the stage, not the crowd. They would not be allowed to show the face of station personnel. The buzz of conversation around me faltered as a low rumbling came from the other side of the pitch. There was a large gap in the advertising hoardings, and, as we all squinted at the source of the sound, it became a loud, throaty roar, and a Challenger tank burst through the gap. It rolled towards us, belching dark exhaust smoke. When it was about 50 yards away from the stage, it stopped and the engine cut out. A few seconds later, the crew of four climbed out and jogged over to the sidelines. "Good evening," I jumped at the voice. There was a red-faced man on stage now, standing at the microphone. It was no one I recognised, but I assumed from the number of medals on his jacket that he was someone important. From what I remembered about uniforms, a general. I was dry-mouthed and nervous. The assembled journalists and invited guests went quiet.
"Thank you for coming tonight. I apologise for the short notice, but it was in the interests of national security. What you are about to witness has been a closely guarded secret within the British military for 3 years.
An interesting piece of disinformation. I wondered if anything he was about to tell us would be true.
The British Army, Navy and Air Force tasked with defending this nation have long been associated with the development of cutting-edge technology. Not only weapons, but early warning computerized radar systems, fighter jets, ships, and submarines.
One of the foreign journalists, Italian, judging by his suit, yawned ostentatiously. His gesture garnered a few smirks from his colleagues.
Tonight, you will meet the culmination of decades of research.
Decades? Of research? Another reason why they get us to sign the Official Secrets Act. They don't want us to point out when they are blatantly lying to everyone.
The man I'm about to introduce will change the way military conflicts are resolved from this day forward. After today, in fact, I don't imagine Great Britain will be challenged militarily ever again.
A murmur spread through the crowd at this. I glanced around and saw nothing but perplexed expressions.
Ladies and gentlemen, this soldier's identity is a matter of national security. However, we all know him by his official army code name. I give you Power Man.
If the general was hoping for a cheer or a round of applause, he was disappointed. He was visibly put out by the chuckles from the journalists present. Then Abos walked out of the players' tunnel, and everyone was quiet again. He was flanked by two beefy-looking soldiers, but he made them look like the caricatured weaklings on seaside postcards. He towered above them, and his strides were so long that they had to trot to keep up. Abos was wearing the British Army uniform I had last seen him in, with one difference. He sported a Royal Air Force helmet, like the ones worn by fighter pilots. It was painted in Union Jack colours. I felt a pang of embarrassment. He also wore flying goggles like a pilot, tinted black, hiding those golden eyes, avoiding any awkward questions. Smart move, I suppose. Shame, though. Abos stood at attention in front of the stage facing us. He was impassive. I looked at his cheekbones and mouth, then tried to picture those honeyed eyes, wondering where he was looking. Just then a little cheer arose spontaneously. I followed everyone's gaze back to the players' tunnel, from which Michael Whiteson had emerged. I'm no fan of athletes, but even I know Michael Whiteson. After winning the 400, 800 and 1500 metres at the 1976 Olympics, he repeated the feat at the Commonwealth Games in Canada last year. Whiteson is the most famous athlete in the country, always on the television or in the papers. He acknowledged the crowd with a little wave, stripped out of his tracksuit, and took up a runner's starting stance at the edge of the pitch. A soldier handed him a silver relay baton.
"Mr. Whiteson has kindly agreed to help us with this first demonstration," said the general. "A race around the perimeter of Wembley Stadium. I think you'd agree that it would be unfair to let them both start at the same time, though."
If the general had been considering a move into public speaking, surely today's engagement will have dissuaded him. Everyone was silent while he laughed at what he considered to be a little joke.
"Aha! Well, of course not. No, we'll give Michael a chance. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Whiteson."
He had the crowd's attention now, even if he had lost their respect for his oratorical skills. We all watched the fastest middle-distance runner in the world set off at a blistering pace. I'd never seen a world-class athlete up close. It's far faster than it looks on TV. Abos walked over to the same starting position, and we waited. Whiteson got a quarter of the way round, then halfway. Abos didn't move. The chuckles started again. When Whiteson hit three-quarter distance, Abos set off. This was accompanied by a huge gasp from everyone, even me, and I was expecting it. Swear words in a dozen languages could be heard as the watchers tracked the blurred figure already rounding the far side of the pitch. Whiteson finished his lap to find Abos waiting for him, the silver baton in his hand. Whiteson looked from his own empty hand to the baton Abos was holding, his face an almost comical picture of disbelief. I glanced around me and saw the mirror of that expression on the features of every hard-bitten, cynical journalist in sight. There were a few similar demonstrations as a warm-up to the main event. The current heavyweight boxing champion was permitted to spend 3 minutes punching Abos, who offered no resistance. The boxer started off jabbing politely, thinking, despite the briefing that he must have been given, that this was some strange publicity stunt. He gradually started to mix in a few harder punches, with horrible, painful-looking body shots and powerful blows to the head. Abos was unmoved by everything the man threw at him. It was over in 2 minutes when the boxer declared himself too exhausted to continue. Abos rattled through a few more sporting demonstrations. His long jump was at least double the length of the current world record, and he managed it without a run-up. He used a cannonball instead of a shot put. A journalist volunteer couldn't lift it at all, but Abos casually tossed it over to the far side of the stadium, where it broke a row of seats in the top tier. He held both arms out from his sides, and four rotund reporters hung off him, two from his left arm, two from his right. His arms didn't sag at all. And after 30 seconds or so, Abos took off for another lap of the stadium, the reporters hanging on for dear life. Halfway round, two of them couldn't hang on any longer, and he carried them back one at a time at high speed. Their hands were shaking so much that I wondered if they would be able to write up their experience. There was one more demonstration of strength before the finale. Abos jogged over to the challenger tank and lifted the front end with one hand while waving to the crowd with the other. There was applause, albeit hesitant. "It's clever, I grant you, but it's a trick," the Irish journalists in front of me were arguing. "How is it a trick?" His colleague, a short red-haired woman, had a softer, less nasal accent. "Come on now, we both saw him run, do you know what I mean?" "Are you sure?" He was smiling a little smugly. "I don't know about you, Kathy, but I saw him clearly in front of me here, and then again at the end of his lap. The rest of the time it was a blur. That could have been anything. I reckon he ducked out of sight while we looked the other way. Classic misdirection. They might have spent weeks, months setting this up. It's quite a show, I grant you, but I don't buy this whole power man nonsense." "Ferg, he just lifted a tank there. Are you facing the right way?" "Hydraulics under the pitch. They parked it in the prearranged spot. All that lanky bloke had to do was to stand there and put his hand on it." She shook her head doubtfully. Then the general started talking again. "Thank you for your time this evening. We will have one more demonstration, and there will be no questions at this time. Press releases with more information will be released within the next few days. Now, I know that representatives of the media have a reputation for being a little sceptical." He paused. There was no response. He coughed. "Much of what you have witnessed might seem impossible. You might even believe you have been victims of a bizarre practical joke." He scanned the faces of the crowd, his manner serious. "This last demonstration is the reason we invited you here this evening. If you were watching this on television, you would assume it was a camera trick. You cannot dismiss the evidence of your own senses so easily. Power Man, over to you." The general left the stage, and all eyes turned to Abos, who had lowered the tank to the ground. He took a few steps away, then, without any theatrics, rose to a height of about 10 feet. The sound the crowd made was the same shocked gasp you hear when a tightrope walker with no safety net suddenly wobbles. Abos flew towards us. I looked over at the cameras and saw the soldiers directing the cameramen to remain focused on the tank. His arms by his sides, his legs together, Abos flew slowly over the entire crowd. As he got close to the top rows, I dropped my head, hoping I wouldn't be too conspicuous, the only person not looking up at him. "Jesus Mary, Mother of God," whispered the first Irish journalist. "I can't see a wire, Ferg," said his colleague. I admired her coolness while watching a man fly. "You idiot." Fergus didn't respond. The collectively held breath of nearly 200 people was expelled unanimously, and I cautiously peeped out from under my hat. Abos was still in the air but was now hovering near the tank again. He reached out a hand and beckoned. The tank groaned as if tons of metal were shifting, then rose, ponderously and impossibly, into the air. Outside Wembley Stadium, life continued as normal. There must have been cars passing, phones ringing, air brakes hissing, children playing, birds singing, the million sounds of a city. But what I remember is a silence so thick it felt that nothing could penetrate it. No one moved, other than to direct their gaze, first at the tank, then at Abos. When the tank shot over the field and took up a position directly above us, no one screamed, no one moved. We all just looked up at it. There was a clump of mud and grass on the tread of the tank near me. I watched it detach and fall, landing with a wet plop on the smart-suited Italian journalist. He didn't react. When the tank flew back to Abos, he closed his hand, very, very slowly, into a fist. As he did so, the tank began to groan loudly. Metal folded onto metal, massive machinery began crumpling in on itself in a cacophony of destruction. Abos crushed the tank as if it were a paper cup. The noise was horrendous, and all the more shocking as it followed that powerful silence. I don't know how long it took. Seconds? Minutes? Abos lowered the remains onto the turf and flew into the dark sky, disappearing from view. We all looked at the huge, roughly spherical mound of metal on the pitch in front of us. The Irish journalist turned to his colleague. "Fuck," he said. October 7th, 1979. The Sunday papers are out. They all used the same photograph. Abos, hovering above the pitch at Wembley Stadium, looking down at the crumpled tank. Here's a selection of the headlines. Super Soldier revealed to stunned world. He can fly, run faster than a Formula One car, and crush a tank just by looking at it. Best of all, he's British. Superhero ate my budgie. The articles go into more depth inside, and there's stunned reaction from the rest of the world. Our allies were given 24 hours' notice of what was to be revealed, apparently. I watched the news this lunchtime, and besides recapping his demonstration over and over and speculating about his origins, it seems the media have not taken to the name Power Man. Thank goodness. From what I saw on television, and from listening to the radio this evening, a dreadful rag that Father won't allow in the house has now renamed Abos. It looks as if this name will stick. The headline read, "Rest of the world, meet the deterrent to end all deterrents." That's what they're calling him. The deterrent. Chapter 31. January 1st, 1980. A year has passed since I last wrote. I reread some of the older diary entries back when Abos was still a secret, before Carstairs had brainwashed him, when it was exciting, fun even, to work with Father at station. If I sound bitter, it's because I am. But I'm more upset at my moral cowardice. I made it my business to find out what was going on, and when my worst suspicions were confirmed, when I found out that Abos was being drugged and manipulated, what did I do about it? Nothing. Worse than nothing. I'm still here, living under the same roof as the man who prepares the chemical cocktail that makes it possible for them to keep Abos under their thumb. My only contact with Abos, the deterrent, is now shared with the rest of the world. I see him on TV, in the papers, the magazines. It's possible to meet him in person at Army, Navy or Air Force recruitment events, but I know I wouldn't be allowed to get close. Applications to join the military have doubled since the deterrent became the face of the British Army. Budgets have swelled too. That makes no sense. Why spend more on munitions and soldiers when there's a superhero on your side? The deterrent has been busy this past year. I suppose his most notable success was the IRA car bomb. That photograph is so iconic now that I've even seen it on T-shirts and printed on children's lunchboxes. Abos is floating above the Thames, a red Ford Cortina held over his head. Tower Bridge can be seen half open behind him. Seconds later, he flew off with the car and dropped it into the North Sea, where it exploded with no loss of life, other than a huge number of very surprised fish. The photographer must have been perfectly positioned near the top of one of the office blocks that line the river. It's such a perfect shot, it's almost as if it were planned that way. Cynical, Cress. Very cynical. Every newspaper wants to interview the deterrent. But his office, yes, there's a deterrent office in the Ministry of Defence at Whitehall, refuses all requests. He's a private man, they're told. The strong, silent type. His physical appearance has been the inspiration for millions of words.